Next case for argument is United States v. Courtwright. Mr. Morris.
May it please the Court, Ms. Gorofsky. I represent Carl Courtwright, who was found guilty in count one of manufacturing child pornography and sentenced to a minimum sentence of life in prison plus 10 years.
What was his defense on count one at trial? It's a little hard to tell from the trial transcript, and I don't think we have the closing argument. What was his defense?
I did not try the case. He didn't testify. And so he really didn't have a focused defense. He certainly didn't, for example, argue about issues such as intent, which is the only issue on which this propensity evidence that was admitted under 413 was offered by the government.
So what was it, just generally he wasn't guilty? No, because you want to decide it in context, then. It's hard to tell what the context is.
Sorry. Excuse me, I got distracted.
That's okay. I'm just saying you have to decide it in context. I mean, and it's hard to do that when you don't really have a clear vision of what the defense was.
Well, in a way, I don't think it matters, because this propensity evidence, which the judge said that its prejudicial effect was minor and that the probative value overwhelmed it, in a 29-page hearing, which is attached in the appendix, never once mentions intent, never once mentions the only potentially proper basis on which this evidence, the L. Miller testimony and the prior convictions, could possibly come in. The court never analyzes it under Rule 403 and couldn't possibly have analyzed it correctly under Rule 403, because it operated under the view which is incorrect, that 413 is the basis on which this evidence could come in.
So even if we give you that was error to let it in, wasn't the evidence on count one pretty overwhelming, even without the testimony of the prior victim? Because in the end, don't we have to look at this from a harmless error standpoint?
I don't think, of course you have to look at the question of whether it's harmful error. I think this is almost sort of constitutionally improper, what happened here. And that is because the evidence was not overwhelming. The government, before the trial and in the closing argument, the prosecutor says that Mr. Courtwright touched SJ. That's just not true. There's no evidence of that. She never testified to that.
Here's what I'm saying. On count one, here's what the evidence was. The pictures themselves in the folder on his computer. The testimony of S.J., the victim, that he took the pictures. The testimony of the victim's boyfriend, that he had been asking about taking the pictures. And the testimony of his fellow inmate, that he said he took the pictures. I'm looking at the ultimate, what was the other evidence? I understand your position on the prior victim.
Well, I think the problem is that prior evidence overwhelmed the opportunity for the jury to do what it must do, which is to consider that evidence you just described and to meet its obligation to find
him. Prior, the previous victim's testimony, it was brief, and it didn't really help the government much, right?
I think it helped them immensely because it paints him as a child molester.
She was very vague about it. And
no,
she didn't even mention.
No, Judge, she said that Courtwright put his finger into her. I mean, that's not vague. That's much worse than anything that's alleged in the present case. It makes him a child molester. And, in fact, the erroneous instructions, the elements instructions that the court gave, give a whole list of sex crimes against minors that the government supposedly had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge never really cures this. He gives the new instructions. I don't know where those elements came from. It appears perhaps that the clerk patched them on to the elements instruction. But I think a point that I want to make...
His counsel agreed with him, right? Wanted him to give those instructions.
I think he got confused about Almendarez and whether he should insist that there be no exception.
I don't think so. He thought the more elements the government has to prove, the better off, the better chance you have for an acquittal.
Maybe that's right, although it seemed to me he was heading in the wrong direction. But
well, the thing is, look, we have to look at when this happened, too. It was when the jury was brought in, the initial instruction was given, and then the next day it was clarified, right?
Not until the next day were instructions given, and there was very little clarification. The judge didn't say, you know, there's not going to be any evidence that, for example, you know, he's had a prior conviction for child pornography.
No, but he said, I started the trial out by making a couple mistakes. When I read you the elements, I suggested there was more, so now I'm going to read to you the real elements that are actually less of a requirement that I read to you yesterday. So he cleaned it up. Nobody used the bad instructions in closing.
No, that's true.
The jury heard all the testimony. They knew the correct elements as they listened.
It's true, but it adds to the environment, which was really distorted, which was this list of prior offenses which he didn't have, then evidence of his offenses coming in through L. Miller, then the closing argument where it said that there was evidence that he had touched her, which isn't true. That changes the question of whether or not he manufactured child pornography. I don't think the jury even thought about it because they had been the critical and most erroneous instruction is number 12, which is at page 36 of the appendix. And it says, evidence of defendant's commission of another offense or offenses of sexual assault or child molestation may be considered by you as evidence. Well, it says another offense, which directly implies or states that the present charge is for an offense or offenses of sexual assault or child molestation.
So
and
what
it
did
wasn't.
SJ actually testify to? I didn't think she got that explicit. I didn't think she was even asked about that offense with the hands during her direct examination.
You're right, Judge. She was not.
So she didn't spell it out at all.
No, and that's the problem. But nevertheless, the prosecutor decided that that would be a good thing to tell the jury, and of course it was. I mean, you know, he's touching her.
Was her testimony about applying lotion or something to her back?
There was. She
Doesn't that involve touching?
That certainly did, but there was no suggestion that that was sexual. In fact, SJ testified.
Well, it applied to her buttocks too, I think.
She said that she was never inappropriately touched by Mr. Courtright ever, and that she had acne, and that she was dressed when this happened, and that he put lotion on her. I'm not saying it's the most appropriate thing, but it's not inappropriate by her own testimony. So it's not.
Whether she deems it appropriate or inappropriate is really not the question. You need an objective view of whether it was appropriate or inappropriate.
I agree, Judge, but of course, there's no charge for that. Courtright's not charged with that. He's charged with taking pictures of her. And the second part of this instruction, number 12, in addition to it implying that the present charges involve a sexual assault or child molestation, it says, evidence of a prior offense on its own is not sufficient to prove the defendant guilty of the crimes charged in the second superseding indictment. That implies that maybe it can't be the only proof of his guilt of manufacturing child pornography, but that this prior propensity evidence can be a substantial portion of it. That breaks the rules about burden of proof.
Yeah, but if we go back to Judge Williams' opening point, if a reasonable jury could not have acquitted him on count one, then it doesn't really matter what improper evidence was presented. That's the test.
Right, but one of the requirements is that they find that there's been lascivious exhibition of genitals, and so the way they weighed that question was with having been told that there was proof that he had touched her. It makes a big difference. There are potentially photographs taken of a naked 14-year-old, which doesn't arise to the level of it being child pornography.
By him? This is not family pictures, huh?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how far to go on this path, but her father was a crack addict. He actually was the only person in the world who actually cared for her, and over a long period of time, cared for her in an appropriate manner and let her, you know, use the house.
But you said no real effort was made to mount a defense of this sort. And, of course, the fact that he was a registered sex offender, that was admissible. And that certainly would be relevant. All right. I don't know.
Well, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. Ms. Grofsky?
May it please the Court. I represent the United States on this case on appeal, and I also was the trial counsel in the case. I want to start out with one of the things that appellant counsel said, which was this helped the jury determine the lascivious display of the images. I would very strongly disagree with that. The jury only had to look at the images to determine the lascivious display of the genitals. One of the images was a close-up of the child's vagina with her hands holding it open for the photograph, and the jury saw that. So this did not at all assist the jury in determining lascivious display. Carl Courtright received a fair trial on this case.
Well, you didn't ask the witness SJ at trial about Courtright putting his hands on hers and posing her, and that's what you argued for the admissibility of 413, but you didn't ask her about it.
That's correct.
And then you used it in closing argument, and there was no testimony about it.
Right, that's correct. I did argue it in closing argument, and I did not ask her about it. Unfortunately, I don't have a transcript before closing argument, and it was from my memory of what she had said previously, and unfortunately it came out. But I do believe it was a reasonable inference from the evidence. She said that he posed her in the positions for the photograph, that he had her hold her vagina open for the photographs, that he had her spit on her vagina, and that he had her masturbate for the photographs. It's a reasonable inference from the evidence that where she said he directed the poses, that there was contact there. But the court doesn't even
have
to...
Was there testimony about this rubbing the lotion or whatever it was?
There was, Your Honor. And I would like to take issue with what appellant said about that as well. The lotion incident involved the defendant applying lotion to the child's back and then to her buttocks, and she said it was very uncomfortable. She asked him to stop. He would not stop. One of her friends walked in on the event. Only then did he stop, but actually he told the friend to leave, got up, went to lock the door, and tried again. So, Your Honor, she did say that he inappropriately touched her. His hands were on her buttocks. When appellate counsel quotes from the transcript where she says that he never inappropriately touched her, it was only after defense counsel had asked her, did he inappropriately touch you? And she said, do you mean other than the lotion incident? And so that's actually an improper quote, I believe, from the transcript.
Well, even so, as I mentioned, it's an objective view of it, not whether she thought it was appropriate.
And that's correct as well, Your Honor. Certainly the child, she's a child, and that's the point. So it's difficult for a child to determine what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. As for the instructional error that happened early on in the trial, this court is correct that the instruction was corrected early on in the case. The jury is presumed to follow the corrected instructions.
I'm bothered by your interpretation of Rules 413 through 415 as applicable to a situation in which there's no charge of one of the sexual offenses, you know, listed in those rules.
I understand.
Just, you know, it may, but just a suggestion that that happened. That seems odd.
I understand that was a unique use of the rule, Your Honor, but under United States versus Rogers, which came out of this court, this court said nothing in the rule implies a word should mean other than its general legal definition. Well, the Black's Law definition of accused is someone implicated in wrongdoing, Your Honor. The framers of the...
Yeah, but...
That's not what accused... It says accused of an offense of sexual assault. That's pretty specific, and that's an accusation of an offense. That's not just a possibility floating around in a case that there are other crimes.
Especially when you look at how other, look at other cases, that Watkins case, the Julian case, the Rodriguez case, the Seeley case. These are all situations where people were charged and 413 came in.
They were all cases, but there's nothing that says it cannot mean accused, as in verbally accused.
So somebody can just point the finger and that's enough for you to say that they're accused? And just an individual can point the finger at someone and that's enough for you?
if it's relevant and direct evidence in the trial, the only reason it wasn't charged is because it's not chargeable in federal court. It met all of the elements of a chargeable offense.
Yeah, pretty strong concession.
So then it's chargeable.
Well, and Your Honor, this court doesn't even have to go that far because the evidence.
But you agree that that's a really your interpretation of accused is really strained, and you don't have any case law to support that interpretation.
That's correct, other than a statutory construction case law, which says that the legislators knew how to say charge.
So there's no case in the country where somebody's interpreted accused to mean charge.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. So in case the court doesn't like my analysis of 413, the evidence was
alternatively... Yeah, you better have a backup position.
The evidence was alternatively admissible under 404B, Your Honors, for intent, motive, and identity. And in
so
fact,
what was his theory of defense? Because it's hard to glean. You know, usually that door is opened by defense counsel. It seems it was just kind of a general I'm not guilty defense. So how did that...
It was sort of a random defense, and it was kind of a spitfire, let's try a whole bunch of different arguments, but one of the arguments was someone else did this. And if the argument is someone else did this, this evidence is admissible as to motive and intent because, as this court has stated before, predilection towards child molestation is not something that everybody has, and it does go to show motive and intent. So, Your Honor,
when he made statements to the police, those statements are all over the board, right? I mean, he denied in some cases and admitted. And
correct. He constantly denied the production count. He admitted some concessions with regard to the receipt and the possession counts, but he gave no ground, in fact, on the production count and always maintained that it was not him. So whereas the government can't just rely on what's going to come in their closing argument in preparing for the case, we had to prepare for everything.
The expert said that was a direct image taken by camera, not down.
Correct, although unfortunately the camera was never found. So the camera was not evidence in the case. So, again, there was the need for evidence of motive and intent.
Okay, well... Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Grabowski. Mr. Varis? Let me ask you a question. Ms. Grabowski did mention 404B. You said, so I'm going to use your words against you. You said that, maybe these pictures he took of SJ, you know, there was maybe a father-daughter relationship, sort of innocent and so on. If that is an issue, then this prior crimes evidence really does bear on intent, right? There are two the intent could have been improper or could have been just family-type stuff. Well, the fact he has a history of this suggests that it is not family. Why isn't that forgetting about 413 and so on, why isn't that an appropriate invocation of 404B?
The prior events were different. The photographs taken of Elle Miller were done at her request and her boyfriend's request. Elle Miller and her boyfriend were apparently having sex in a van at the property.
Sure, but that's the area of a district judge's discretion. How similar is it? You know, is it really the same or different? That doesn't sound extreme error. I mean, I understand the business with the instructions, the additional two elements. That's bizarre, but of course that actually benefited the defendant. So.
Well, but the more important instruction...
It would really hurt, apart from the harmless error issue, I'm not sure... You know, there are a lot of pratfalls here, but I'm not sure which ones actually hurt you.
I think what really hurt is instruction number 12, which let the jury convict him on the basis of these prior acts. And I think that was an overwhelmingly prejudicial event. And to tell the jury that they could actually find his guilt based on this prior conduct, it's not only saying you can consider propensity evidence, it's saying you can do it to find him guilty of the elements of the offense. Secondly,
what did it say? You have to remind me.
It says,
I'm looking at
it's an application, I'm Appendix 36.
Well, it said evidence of a prior offense on its own is not sufficient to prove the defendant guilty of the crimes charged.
Exactly. So it says...
That's maybe not well... But that's not inaccurate, right? Because any evidence that's admissible, other than, you know, cross-examination stuff, but any actually admissible evidence is a basis on which to prove a defendant guilty.
That's true, but if it's all propensity evidence, if it only
But it's not just propensity evidence, right? It's intent evidence. So it is legitimate for the jury to look at that prior conduct to make a judgment about his intent with regard to the offense charge. It couldn't base its entire judgment on that. That would not be reasonable. You can't use just that evidence to convict, right?
I think it bolsters it greatly. Also, the government's position is they only wanted to offer the evidence for intent, and that was its only purpose. And yet, the very next instruction, number 13, says you have heard evidence of acts of the defendant other than those charged in the second superseding indictment. You may consider them only on the question of proof of motive, intent, plan, or absence of mistake. So that one gives the 404B instruction and expands the scope of relevance way beyond what even the government said it should be.
I didn't understand. You said that instruction 13 was about intent also. I don't.
It does, but it expands it to
well, intent, plan, I mean, that's just lawyers repeating words, right? Different synonyms. Lawyers love synonyms, right?
So you would have liked it to just say intent.
I think it should have only said intent,
even though you don't think it should have been used.
I think it demonstrates how confused the whole thing was, because you don't even need two instructions. If it's 404B evidence, there should have been a proper instruction, not one that said you can consider it for any purpose. That's the problem here. It was allowed for any purpose, not just with respect to intent.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Maher. So you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Ms. Borofsky as well.